I'm pulling out my driveway. We all know what that means. It's time for the drive to work. Okay, so I recently got back from MagicCon Chicago 2025. And at MagicCons, I tend to give a talk. And usually the talks are 60 minutes. I have lots of slides. And mostly it's a means for me to tell design stories secretly. That's what it's about. I pick a topic. I've learned that 20 is about the right number of things to talk about. My big GDC talk, 20 years, 20 lessons. 20 is about the right amount. In an hour, it's about the right amount of things I can talk about. So I've done stuff like the top 20 best mechanics and worst mechanics. So this time, I did the top 20 most influential designs. So let me define what I meant by that, because I as with most talks, I sort of clarify what it is I mean. So I'm looking for card designs, although in a few cases, I did cycles rather than a single card. I mean, originally I just picked a card out of the cycle, and I'm like, okay, it's really the cycle. So a few of them are of the whole cycle. The idea is there were three things that had to be true for me to pick it. Number one, it had to be something that was very popular when it came out. Something that really, like, people really got attracted to and liked. One is it had to be doing something innovative, something we hadn't done before. Two is it had to be very popular. And three, it had to inspire R&D to do other stuff with it. That really was sort of, these are things that are foundational. Like, we did something, the response, you know, we did something new, the response was overwhelming, people really liked it, and we did more. That's sort of the idea. This is not a talk about the first time we did something. My example was I showed Taste of Paradise in the talk. And I'm like, okay, who knows what this card is? It's a card from Alliances. Taste of Paradise is thought of as kind of the first kicker card, but it wasn't a popular card. It didn't stand out. We didn't make a kicker because of it. We sort of made kicker, and it happens that this was the precursor of it. So maybe one day I'll do a talk of the earliest versions of effects or something. That's a fine talk, but that's a different talk. And the other thing I always say on my talks is, look, this is my opinion. I did talk to R&D. I did take other people's opinions into this. But in the end, my opinion, I ordered them. There's clear bias showing here. And the other thing, which I didn't say in the talk, but I will say here now, is the whole point of this is for me to have a fun talk and tell fun stories. So sometimes they pick things because I got a good story to tell. So this is a pretty good, these are 20 very good examples of what I'm talking about. Did I miss one or something? Maybe. I'm not saying this is, you know, it was for my talk, and I thought it was, I do like this list. Did I miss anything? I'm sure I did. Okay, number 20, Mindslaver from the set of Mirrodin. By the way, I also, for each of these things, I want to mention who the designer was, just cause, hey, I like giving credit where credit is due. Ironically, Mindslaver was by me. I made Mindslaver. So the story of Mindslaver is a very interesting one. It actually goes all the way back to Alpha. So in Alpha, there's a card called Word of Command, which I think is a spell in D&D, I believe, in Dungeons & Dragons. So the idea is it's a spell where you take over a fellow wizard and you cast one of their spells is the idea. So the flavor of this, it was clear what Richard intended. You cast a spell. Now you can go into your opponent's hand and use their mana to cast their spell. And the flavor and the idea was really cool that I'm taking over my fellow planeswalker. The problem was, a lot of the time what would happen is, you know, let's say, for example, they have a Swords to Plowshares and a Planes open. So you were to command them and you look in their hand, you know, you're going to see that to cast it. But in response to you casting it, they could just swords one of your creatures, right? A lot of the problems was they get a response to you casting the word of command. And oftentimes, if there's something you could do with the word of command, they will just do it first to keep you from messing with them. So the idea of the spell was a really cool concept, but the execution wasn't great. And so one of the things that was on my mind is I really wanted to make Word of Command 2.0. How do I take control? Like, how do I cast a spell out of my opponent's hand? And I spent a lot of time sort of thinking about it. And in the end, what I realized was that I needed to capture them in such a way that I had full access to what they had, right? That I had untapped land. I had at least a spell that I could cast. And that's when I came up with the idea of, well, what if I'm not just sort of taking over a single moment in time? What if I'm taking an entire turn? And I came up with a text, which I liked a lot, gain control of target player. And the idea meant that for one turn, instead of them playing their turn, I played their turn. And that seemed really cool. And the neat thing about it was their mana would untap, they'd draw a card, and it's sort of like everything would be refreshed, and now you get to do something, and they can't really mess with you. I mean, maybe, you know, if you activate it before your turn ends, they can cast an instant or something. But they're still going to draw a card. You know, you still have a lot of access to things. And by taking control of their turn, it's not just even casting spells. You get to decide how they attack. Like, you just get a really... You get to sort of mess them up in a fun way. And I really liked that idea. So anyway, what happens is, at the time I'm working on Tempest. Tempest was the first set I led. And it turns out there's a character in Tempest, Volrath, the main villain of Tempest, who I liked the idea that he had a device, a helm of control, that he could use to take control of other people. And in the story, he actually takes control of Gerard with it. I was very excited. Like, this is, like, it fits in the story. It is this nice, you know, out-of-the-box, cool thing. So I go to the rules manager at the time, which was Tom Wiley, the very first rules manager, and I say, can I do this? And he goes, I think so. So we commission the art, we got everything all set up, it's all ready, it's in the story, everything's ready to go. And then Tom comes back and goes, yeah, I don't think I can get it to work. So the last minute, is it Helm of Control? There's a helm with Volrath on it, that ends up stealing a creature. I mean, something that is magic's done that. We control magic with an alpha. So it's nothing new. Not that a bad card, having an artifact that can steal creatures isn't horrible or anything, but it isn't, you know, it wasn't the exciting thing that Mindslaver was supposed to be. So anyway, Mindslaver sort of goes in the drawer. The junk drawer of my head where designs go when they don't quite make it. But anyway, flash forward a bunch of years, we're working on Mirrodin. And I'm leading Mirrodin. And Mirrodin, the idea was, starting with Invasion, we were starting doing theme blocks, right? And so Invasion was the artifact block. And I really wanted to, like, do some really cool artifacts because we were doing an artifact block and it was an artifact set. And so I went back and I looked through the junk drawer and I remembered Mindslaver. So we had a new rules manager at the time. Paul Barkley was his name. So I go to Paul and I say, Paul, can I do this? Can I do Mindslaver? And Paul goes, I think so. Now, I've learned, like, the one thing about one of the key things is being a magic designer is be aware that you keep getting new rules managers and different rule managers will accept or not accept certain things, and maybe one rule manager can figure out how to do something that another rule manager couldn't do. And no slight against Tom, just time had gone by. We had evolutions. We had done more things, you know. There just was more to work with. And like, it's not a strike against Tom. But anyway, Paul Barkley came back and said, yes, we can do it. And so they figured out a way to make it work, and Mindslaver was created. My only, looking back, I really like Mindslaver. I do wish there were two words added to Mindslaver. I wish it said Exile Mindslaver, because doing it once in a game is kind of fun. Doing it continually every turn, not so fun. So I wish I had done that. Anyway, this card, when I talk about sort of inspirations, there's both sort of the direct inspiration and the indirect inspiration. The direct inspiration is just the idea of taking control of another player's turn. It is something, it's a very special something. We don't do it a lot, but it's a really cool effect, and we've used it in a couple different places. The lesser sort of influence is just the idea of the value of sort of cool words, that the idea of gain control of target player, even if you don't completely understand what that means. I mean, there's reminder text to tell you what it means. But that sounds cool. Gain control of target player. I don't even know what that does, but that sounds cool. And so a lot of idea of, we realize the value is kind of the pithy rule text. The other one example I gave in the talk was end the turn. End the turn. I mean, yeah, there's like six lines of reminder text explaining what exactly that means, but it sounds really cool. And so really this got us into the idea of the value of words. Okay, number 19, Form of the Dragon. This is from Scourge. Brian Tinsman created Form of the Dragon. So the idea was he wanted a spell that said, I turn myself into a dragon. That was his inspiration. And he's like, okay, well, what does it mean? What does it mean if I'm a dragon, right? What does that mean? And so he said, okay, well, he went and looked, what is the most, like, typical dragon of magic? And he said, the Shivan Dragon from Alpha. It's a 5-5. It flies. It is fire-breathing. Like, how can I, you know, I want to turn into a Shivan Dragon. So first off, he said, okay, well, it's important that I'm a creature, right? I'm a dragon. I'm not a planeswalker. I'm a dragon. Or maybe I'm a planeswalker. It is a dragon. But whatever. I'm not a person anymore. I've turned into a dragon. Also, he said, okay, I got to fly. Like, dragons fly. That's important. And I breathe fire. So he said, okay, how do I capture those three things? So for breathing fire, he said, well, what if every turn I just get to do direct damage? Much like a dragon, I now have a source of doing direct damage. I can breathe fire. So I do 5 damage every turn. And once again, he was thinking of the Shivan Dragon. Five, you know, you're a 5-5 dragon, so every turn you can do 5 damage. And if you want to think about, like, you're attacking with a dragon or doing fire breathing, I think fire breathing because he can hit whatever target he wants. But you also can think of it as attacking. Okay, and then flying. How do you capture flying? He said, well, what if no one can attack you if they're not a flying creature? Now, that was a little contentious at the time. Essentially, that's like a moat effect, which is white and not remotely red. But at the time when we talked through Cowardpie, we're like, well, the collection of the whole thing is really, really red. You're turning into a dragon. We said, it's a bend, but oh, okay. And then the third thing, which was kind of the most radical, is the idea that your life total is 5. And that end of turn, like at the end of turn, you always go back to 5. And the idea is, I'm a dragon. A dragon has a toughness of 5. But like a creature, I heal back up at the end of turn. You know, so if you damage me and I go down to 2, well, end of turn, I go back to normal. Like if a Shivan Dragon gets 3 damage on it, well, that damage dissipates and it's back to 5-5. And so the idea there was, okay, I breathe fire, I fly, and I'm a creature. So that spell was obviously we've done some stuff with Form of. Mostly we've done like Form of the Squirrel and Form of the Dinosaur and Form of the Approach of the Second Sun. But really that model, that's once again the minor thing. The major thing is really this idea of all-in top-down design. And what I mean by that is if you look at the component pieces of Form of the Dragon, you do direct damage, flyers can't attack you, and your life total goes to 5. In a vacuum, it doesn't make any sense. It just feels like 3 random abilities. It doesn't feel like there's no cohesiveness to it. But when you add the flavor onto it, you're turning into a dragon, all of a sudden those connected pieces make sense. And it really hammered home the power of how flavor can really take something and you can make something you normally would never make. You would never make that spell in a vacuum because it doesn't make any sense. But when you tie it together, there's a lot of flavor. And then, you know, that is a well we've gone to again and again. Just the idea of the individual pieces are a little weird, but the totality is so that color that it's just, you know, mwah. I've told a similar story about a Croan horse, which basically the Trojan horse. And at one point, instead of being a horse, they made it a lion. And the point was, it got so far away from the Trojan horse that people didn't understand it, and it just felt like it didn't make any sense. Once you understand, oh, we're doing the Trojan horse, I got it. Like, it's very clever and fun. But if you don't quite make the connection, it seems odd. Okay, that was number 19, Form of the Dragon. Number 18, Ajani's Pride Mage from Core 2011. This is was designed by Matt Place. So, Ajani's Pride Mate, so it's a creature that every time you gain life, it gets +1/+1 counters. So the way it came about is in Core 2011, they decided they wanted to bring back the original 5 Lorwyn plane captures, the Lorwyn 5. And not just bring back exactly their Lorwyn cards with their Lorwyn art. And then to play it up, they made a cycle of commons and a cycle of uncommons that represent those characters. All of them had the character of the Planeswalker's name in it, and a lot of them had the Planeswalker on the card. Not all of them, but a lot of them did in the art. So anyway, the uncommon for a Johnny was a Johnny's Pride Mate. So when Matt was making the card, he looked at a Johnny, the Planeswalker, and he said, okay, what does a Johnny do? And Johnny's first ability was life gain, and his second ability was putting +1/+1 counters. Johnny's always been, I mean, obviously, he started as mono white. He's now sort of white green. But, and he always was about being protective and helping, you know. His ability is more help others than help himself. It's kind of the theme of Johnny. But anyway, Matt was like, I like life gain. I like counters. Both of them are cool things. Is there a way to interconnect them, to join them together? And then that's when he realized that he could do what we call input output. Is one of the abilities is the input, one ability is the output. And obviously, you could either, whenever you get a +1 counter, gain some life. Or whenever you gain some life, get a +1/+1 counter. He decided the second one was just a cooler thing. We know from just watching Magic, life gain is very popular with players, especially less experienced players. And +1/+1 counters is very popular with players. So you're taking two things we knew players really liked and put them together. And it ended up being like a really good package. It ended up being something that players really liked. In fact, on Arena, I'm not sure this is still true, but for a long time, it was the most, when people get the card, the most, I'm blanking on the word, but the most redeemed card, the card that people wanted to get the most. And it is something that we've gone to. We've made a lot of creatures that have that ability. We've made enchantments that grant it and auras. And it's just really a go-to thing that we've used in a lot of different places. And one of the things that I mentioned in the talk is one of the signs that it's very influential is when it's vocabulary for R&D. We talked about making a pride mate. Does this want to be a pride mate? Like, that is how impactful it is that it's like it's a tool in our tool belt, you know, that we can make a pride mate. So the idea that when we use the name to represent the concept, that really means it's very impactful, that it's both that we know players like it and that we know we should be making this. It's something that you know, is a good resource for us. Okay, that was number 18. Number 17, Gonti, Lord of Luxury, from Kaladesh. So Ian Duke was the designer of this card. Ian Duke co-led the development for Kaladesh. This is back in the design development days. Sean Main and I co-designed it, and then Ian, along with Eric Lauer, co-developed it. So what happened was they had the character. So often the way it works is the story is fleshed out early on. It's not written yet. They usually don't write the story until after the set is put to bed, because they want to be able to reference things in the set, and it's easier, just for a lot of reasons, it's done later. But we know the characters that are going to be in the story. The outline of the story is done. The story isn't written yet, but the outline is done. So we know roughly who the characters are. So they came to Ian and Eric and said, okay, here's the list of characters. Well, one of the characters was Gonti. And Gonti at his core, he was an Aetherborn. So he obviously had a legendary creature, Aetherborn. And he was he was a criminal. He was sort of a kingpin. And they liked the idea that he was stealing from others, you know, he stole from others. And so Ian was influenced by a card. There was a card in Theros, and there also was a card in Guild Pact. Gatecrash. And both of them stole stuff from your opponent and then let you cast them. And he was very intrigued by this, the idea that, like, I'm a thief, and what am I stealing from? I'm stealing from my opponent. So the idea of Gonti is when you attack and you deal damage, you look at, I think it's the top four cards of your opponent's library, and then you get to pick one and exile it. And then you're able to cast that card. We refer to that now as the Gonti effect. Stealing and casting cards from your opponent is what we call the Gonti effect. Gonti was super flavorful. People really liked the character. And so that one, the Gonti, the first Gonti, steals from the library. We've learned there's a lot of places you can steal from. You can steal from their library, their hand, the battlefield, their graveyard, the stack. Pretty much any zone you can steal from. You don't steal from library a lot. Well, that's right, we do from top of library, like Gonti does. So anyway, it's something, it's an effect that we've gone to a lot. And like I said, we refer to it as the Gonti effect. So it definitely is something that, like, one of the things that, like, we have to be careful is, it's fun to mess with your opponent, but you got to be careful not to mess with them too much. And so it is definitely an effect we have to be careful with. Because, like, for example, there's a card called Bribery, that you go into the opponent's library and just take their best creature. And what we learn there is, the idea that I can just go get whatever I want and I take the best thing is very punishing. That's why, like, this is like tap a library. Like, you get to take something, but you don't have total control of what you take. And that's kind of important, that it's not that you're just absolutely taking the absolute best thing. You don't want to punish them for, like, you know, how dare you play this thing. But it's something where you sort of have some unpredictability of what you're getting that's important. Anyway, guys, that is number 17, Gonti. Number 16, Ball Lightning from the Dark. So Ball Lightning was the creation of Jesper Myrforce. So Jesper Myrforce, for those who may be unaware of the name, he was Magic's first art director. He worked with Chris Rush, who did a lot of graphic design. They made the Magic card back, the Magic logo, the frames, the mana symbols. And Jesper was one of the, not only was he an art director, the first art director, he also was an artist. So he did Word of Command, he did Bad Moon, so he did a bunch of cards in Alpha, so he's also an artist. And in fact, he was the lead designer of the Dark, and I believe that's the only time that an art director has been the lead designer of a set. His idea behind the Dark was he was very into mood and tone. And the idea is, oh, there's five colors of Magic, but each color has a dark side. Let's tap into the dark side of each color. That was the idea. That is why it's the Dark. It's the dark side of each color. But anyway, one of the ideas that he was very enamored by is, when Magic began, there were direct damage spells. That, you know, Alpha had Fireball and Lightning Bolt and Disintegrate. And there were creatures, you know, Shivan Dragon and Hill Giant and such. And he noticed that there were occasionally creatures like Orcish Oriflamme or something. Orcish Artillery, sorry. There were creatures that could tap to direct damage. But he was intrigued by, was there really a creature that was direct damage? Not something that was, that could sort of do direct damage, but itself was direct damage. He was intrigued by that idea. So what he came up with is, imagine I have a creature that at the end of the turn I sack it. Meaning it's a creature for only one turn. So it's like direct damage in that it does one amount of damage, but it's a creature and has to interact with creature things. So he said, okay, first off, I got to give it haste, because it has to attack the turn I play it. I got to give it trample, because I wanted to get through for damage, and he made it a 6-1. The idea was it doesn't need much toughness, it's going to die anyway. And you want high power, because it's got trample. And you, like, the idea is you want to get through for as much as you can. And if they block with a creature, the cool thing about the Ball Lightning is it'll destroy the creature, you know. So the idea is my opponent has to figure out how much damage they want to take and sort of what do they want to throw in the way. And 6-1, and also he made it cost red, red, red. So it's pretty aggressive. It comes up pretty early. You know, it's not, once again, it's a cross between the creature and direct damage. It doesn't last. It doesn't stick around. And so there's an interesting balance there. But the idea is it still acts like a creature and has to do damage the way a creature would do damage. Anyway, Ball Lightning was definitely definitional in sort of what it was. R&D refers to making ball lightnings. In the slideshow, I literally went through every ball lightning we'd ever made, and there's a whole bunch of them. I mean, and once again, we've played around with variants. There's ball lightnings that you can do something and keep it around. There's ones that you can change the size. I mean, there's a lot of different things you can do. But anyway, it definitely is a staple of something we do to this day. And the other interesting thing from a sort of historical standpoint is, so Haste shows up in Alpha on Nether Shadow and Instill Energy. Haste as a keyword doesn't exist till 6th edition, but it's written out so that the Nether Shadow, when it comes out of the graveyard, can attack, and Instill Energy sort of grants your creature Haste. Then in Legends, there was Concordant Crossroads that grants all your creatures Haste. But it's not till Ball Lightning, which is in the Dark right after Legend, in which there's a creature that just has haste, meaning I want to play with it and attack it the turn I attack. And it's the first time it shows up in red. And we've made over 400 mono red haste creatures. It's a key identity of red now. But Ball Lightning was the first time it happened. The first, like, mono red creature with haste doesn't happen until Ball Lightning. So that is why Ball Lightning is number 16. Number 15, fact or fiction. This is invasion. Remember I talked earlier about how in the third age of mad design, we started doing blocks that had themes. So invasion was multicolor. Odyssey was graveyard. Onslaught was typo. You know, Mirrodin was artifacts. Shams Kamigawa was top down. But anyway, invasion was monocolor. And in invasion, so the three designers for invasion were myself, Bill Rose, and Mike Elliott. And the three of us came up with a mechanic that we didn't name. It was an unnamed mechanic called Divi. There were six cards in invasion. And the way Divi worked is somebody was forced to, out of some zone, some number of cards, make two piles. And then the other player had to choose the two piles, and then something happened with them. Now, to continue the story, let's go back a little bit in time. So, a few years earlier, Urza's Saga block had come out. Urza's Saga. And for those who don't know your history, it went badly. It's probably the most broken block we've ever released. I mean, Alpha also is very powerful, but I don't count that against it. Alpha was the first, you know, it's very hard to have your power level correct when you've never made anything before. But anyway, Urza Saga was quite broken. So much so that for the only time, this year in October marks my 30 years working on Magic. In my 30 years, this is the only time this happened. The president at the time was Peter Atkinson, one of the founders of Wizards, and he was the first CEO. He called us in his office and he chewed us out. And he said, if you ever make a set as broken as Urza Saga, I'm firing all of you. And by the way, the next set that came out was Mercadian Masks, the next block. So anyway, we had a big discussion afterwards, and I remember Bill was saying, okay, we need to find people that are better at sort of breaking things. And I said, well, I have an idea for you. So at the time, I was working on the Pro Tour. First 8 years of the Pro Tour, I was a regular on the Pro Tour. I used to run the feature matches, and I would run commentary on the final day, and I did a lot of, like, I helped a lot with the production on the final day. Also, one of my jobs was I was the liaison with the players, meaning if there was a delicate situation that someone had to talk with the players about, it got to be me. I was the one that did that. But what it meant was I got to know the players really well. And so I said to Bill, I go, I think there's players off the Pro Tour that would be very good at being developers, that are very good at sort of cracking things. And so one of the early people that I recommended was Randy Bueller. Randy had won the very first Pro Tour Chicago, and it was a clearly really smart player. I'd spent a lot of time talking with Randy. The funny story about Randy is it took a while to actually get Randy. I think I got his resume into something, and then somehow it got in the discard pile, and I had to go, no, really, Bill, you got to look at this resume. And I set up a lunch so that Bill and Randy could have lunch together. It went well. We hired Randy. So Randy's first big thing was he was the lead developer of Invasion from the Deep End. And I remember when he's looking at the Divi cards, one of them really stood out, which was Fact or Fiction. And the thing he really liked about Fact or Fiction was that it was this very spiky card, in that the better a player you were, the better the card was. That the card became stronger in the hands of a stronger player. And Randy said that we need more stuff like that. It's really fun to have something that's sort of a skill, like the power has some skill testing to it. So originally, I think the card cost 5 mana, 4 and a blue, and he dropped it to 3 and a blue. He's like, I want to be aggressive with this card. I think this is very fun Magic. And Randy was correct. It is very fun Magic. And so Fact or Fiction came out, is really popular. And just the whole idea of dividing and then you get to pick the pile and you get the cards. Sort of directly, I mean, there's a lot of fun to the Divi, but specifically sort of the Fact or Fiction Divi. Dividing two cards and I'm going to draw the one pile. And we've messed around with it, whether they're both open or one's secret and one's not. I mean, we've tried a lot of variants of it. But it's something we've done on spells, on creatures. We particularly like it on sphinxes. It's just something we use in a lot of places. And just really hammering home, like, what makes a good spike card. And the idea that a card that, like, rewards skill, that the power level of the card rewards skill, is something we've definitely taken with us. Okay, guys, normally I would be at work because I'm hitting my 30-minute mark here, but I'm not at work. There's traffic today. So I get to do one more. Mishra's Factory from Antiquities. So this was created by David Petty, one of the East Coast playtesters. I talk to them all the time. They're the people that made antiquities and Ice Age and alliances and fallen empires. They were one of the original playtesters. A really good design team. So they were making Antiquities, which was the second ever Magic expansion. So let's talk land. So when Richard Garfield made Alpha, he made 15 lands. There were 5 basic lands and 10 dual lands. So in Alpha, all lands did is they tapped for mana. That's all they did. There's nothing else they did. They just tapped for mana. So in Arabian Nights, which Richard also made, he started messing around a little bit with, like, what if lands did other things? So all the lands in Arabian Nights did something beyond mana. Half of them produce mana. Half of them don't produce mana. We later decided that one of the rules that we have of lands now is they either have to produce mana or go get you lands that will produce mana. We really want lands and mana connected together, thematic. We think that's important. We make rare exceptions to that, but that's a pretty important rule. He introduced the idea that lands could do other things. So we come to Antiquities. So there are 6 lands in Antiquities. There's the Urza-Tron and Mishra's Workshop. So those 4, mostly what they do is they provide more mana, right? The Urza-Tron provides extra mana. It lands a tap for more than one. All of them actually tap for more than one under the right conditions. The Urza-Tron, you got to turn on. But Mishra's Workshop, you only get to use it for artifacts, but it's an artifact theme set. Then they made Strip Mine, which I don't know what they were thinking. I'm not sure why. Stone Rain, you know the problem with Stone Rain? It costs mana. That was the problem with Stone Rain. Anyway, Strip Mine, not an accident. Or not that. Anyway, we should have made Strip Mine. The final card was Mishra's Factory. So David's inspiration for Mishra's Factory, there's a card in Alpha called Jade Statue. So Jade Statue is an artifact that you can spend mana to turn it into a creature. So Dave was very enamored by the idea of something that isn't always a creature, but that could become a creature. And he said, wouldn't that be cool on a land? Like, wouldn't that be neat for a land that could do that? And he also came up with the idea that the land could help itself. So, like, if you had 2 Mishra's Factories, one of them you can animate, the other one could pump the first one. And that dynamic was super fun. Anyway, Mishra's Factory was such a staple card. There's a period of time where people really didn't play creatures. But everybody played Mishra's Factory. Mishra's Factory didn't die to a Wrath of God, but it still could attack. So the idea of sort of creature lands was, the very first set I did was Tempest. I put in a card called Stalking Stones. The difference I did there was it permanently became a creature, rather than you have to keep activating it. But the idea of lands that become creatures is just a time-tested staple. Once again, one of the funs, I can't do this on the podcast, but in the slideshow, I would just run through it. I'd quickly run through all the examples of all the different creature lands we've done over the, and there's a lot. It's a lot of slides. My talk, usually the way I build in Keynote, and I like having a lot of visuals, just so the screen's constantly moving and you're seeing as I'm talking about things. And the more time I have to practice, the more slides I get. So my GDC talk back in 2016, which I spent a lot of time on, had like 1,000 slides. This one, which I spent about a month on, had 850 slides. But a lot of that was me just clicking through, like, look at all the different things that have done whatever it is we were talking about. So, anyway, Mishra's Factory definitely sort of gave us a resource. It really sort of, it was, I think it was the most popular of the early I do something other than just mana lands. Obviously, Library of Alexander. There were other ones that definitely saw some play. I think Mishra's Factory was it really sort of the idea also of I have my land for mana, but that I also have other things that I can do with it, and then maybe I have one that's colorless and it has such utility that I in fact will play it. Anyway, Mishra's Factory was very informative and it did a lot of stuff, and so that is why Mishra's Factory is number 14. Okay, guys, I'm now at work, and I got through a third of the list, so that's a good sign. Obviously, I will be doing 2 more of these to finish up the whole thing. So anyway, I hope you're enjoying it. But as I'm now at work, we all know what that means. It means it's the end of my drive to work. So instead of talking magic, it's time for me to be making magic. I'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.